Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our reviewers this week are Leo Lowenstein and Andy Klein. Joining them later for a look at the best of the first half of 2022 are Tim Cogshell and Amy Nicholson. As we listen to the terrific theme from Jordan Peele's Get Out, it prepares us for our critics' review of Peele's new movie, Nope. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer in another very eerie story. The Australian sex comedy, How to Please a Woman, delivers a completely different vibe. The movie's all-male house cleaning crew provides the service. And Andy Klein's one of the foremost appreciators of wild action films. We've got one from Japan. It's Baby Assassins. Something for most of us on this week's Film Week, right after NPR News.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us today for the reviews of all the week's movies and some extended conversation with our critics as well. I'm joined by Andy Klein and Leo Lowenstein this week. And we begin with Jordan Peele's new film, Nope. Peele wrote and directed it. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer, Steven Yeun in the cast as well. And it's set in California, the sci-fi horror film. Andy, please start us on Nope.
Sure. I'm about 87 to 92% yup on Nope. And the only reason I'm not higher than that is because I love Jordan Peele's first two films so much. I thought Get Out was terrific, and I thought that Us was even better. This seems a little less well worked out, though it is still, he knows how to do the horror suspense thing. It's about a black family who runs a horse training horse wrangler ranch, and they're in business troubles, and the father who has been the one really running the business gets killed in a mysterious way very early on, like about 3 minutes on, that has something to do, we think, with what is to follow. And what is to follow is amidst Daniel Kaluuya's problems trying to keep the business together and deal with his completely opposite personality sister. He's very reticent and laconic, and she is a motor mouth. They begin to observe strange phenomena over their ranch, and the phenomena appear to maybe be a UFO. This is something that is not really resolved until well into the film. But it's a scary phenomenon, and it is one that he milks really well. I mean, the guy knows how to do horror and suspense setups. the scene I particularly loved is a scene where you see nothing exciting happening except for Daniel Kaluuya sitting in a truck trying to. It's very much like the scenes in Nightmare at 10,000 Feet, which Jordan Peele did as one of the Twilight Zone episodes.
Yeah. It's the Shatner episode where he's on a plane.
He's on a plane, and am I going to look out the window? And here is the guy sitting there going, am I going to get out of the car? And he's just sitting there, and he goes, nope. And there'll be like a 30-second pause, and he starts to get out, and he said, nope. And he's right to say nope. So basically, he and his sister and a worker at Fry's, although I thought Fry's were all shut down every place now, are trying to record this phenomenon, which they think is the UFO. And, you know, something to get some fame and money out of it. But, of course, it's a little too scary for that. The problem with the film, it's, like I say, great scenes, some beautifully shot stuff. The special effects are almost retro at times. There are special effects that reminded me of, well, I'm going to say a Matthew Barney film, but nobody remembers. but the whole logic behind what's going on is not well worked out. And there are side episodes in this that are really, it's not clear entirely how they fit in. There's a flashback to 25 years earlier to a TV show where a chimpanzee went crazy and attacked everybody. And maybe this has something to do with the general theme of nature taking revenge, and that may be what's happening with this phenomenon out in the fields. But it's not clear. I mean, it's like he sets up thematic stuff, and it didn't seem as perfectly worked out as it was in his two previous films.
No, hold the thought, because I want to get Lael into this. We're talking about the new film from Jordan Peele that he wrote and directed, Nope. Lael, how did you see it?
Yeah, I agree with Andy. When this film works, it is absolutely thrilling. And it would be great if you could to see it in IMAX. It's shot in IMAX and it's meant for that. There is no one better than Jordan Peele right now at blending suspense, horror, and humor. I can't think of anyone, maybe even since Hitchcock, who does it as well as he does. And here he adds the Western to the mix. It's, you know, it's genre bending and genre blending, and all the technical elements are absolutely top notch, you know, especially the sound design, which is so, so intense. And the visuals, just his complete mastery of, you know, where to pan the camera to and how to sort of build suspense. And, you know, Kiki Palmer as the sister, Daniel Kaluuya, who is, you know, so taciturn, but says so much just with his eyes. It is an incredibly, you know, magnificent film when it works. But like Andy said, there are a lot of loose ends, and it feels as if the script, the sort of the weave of the film should have been tightened, because there's these threads that just don't kind of connect. The whole thing about the chimpanzee in the, which is, that's how the film opens. We see this prologue of a chimp having gone completely bananas and is covered with blood and has, you know, wrought carnage on this TV set. And it's sort of explained later, but again, pieces are not all put together. It is kind of a thrilling and new complete production design in terms of even in re-envisioning aliens, an alien spaceship. We've never seen anything quite like this before. But again, so much is left unsolved, unexplained, which is okay. You expect some lack of resolution with anything involving sci-fi, UFOs, things like that. But there's maybe a little more than I would have liked to see. I sat next to Claudia Puig, and I turned to her afterwards and I said, I have so many questions. And she said, so do I. but I mostly really enjoyed it. And I think Peele is just really working at the top of his game. And, you know, I'd love to see what else he comes up with. And again, terrific film.
Lael, one of the things I'm really glad you raised is how accomplished he is at that injecting humor into horrific circumstances. And for me, that's what stands out most about Get Out, is it made the scary stuff even scarier. And I know that seems contradictory. You would think the humor would pull you out of it, but it was something about allowing the space for the humor and characters to be funny in that film, which made the horror even more intense because it disarms you in a sense.
And, that's right.
And there's real mastery in doing that effectively.
It does a few things. I mean, for one thing, just a little bit of comic relief lets a little bit of the pressure off, so you can sort of keep going. And it also engages you because, you know, there is sort of gallows humor in moments like that where you're completely stressed out. And so his mastery of tone is absolutely just extraordinary and exceptional. And there's, you know, as Andy mentioned also, there's some Hollywood history here too. And I think he's sort of also commenting on marginalized, you know, stuntmen and things like that and the whole Black experience. But it's not, the metaphors aren't as clear here as they are, let's say, in Get Out and Us.
Nope is the film from filmmaker Jordan Peele. He wrote and directed it. Daniel Kaluuya stars with Kiki Palmer. It's rated R in wide release. The Australian romantic comedy How to Please a Woman stars Sally Phillips and Eric Thompson. It's written and directed by Renee Webster. Lael.
This is just a really charming Australian sex comedy in which a middle-aged woman who finds herself in a stale marriage and has been laid off by her boss. She's like at an insurance funding company. She's feeling kind of at a dead end in her life. She gets sent by some of her middle-aged girlfriends a singing telegram male stripper for her birthday. And she is completely horrified, demands that he put his clothes back on. And he says, well, I'm here to do whatever you want. And she says, okay, fine, clean my house. And this actually reminds me of a comedic book I saw about 10 years ago called Porn for Women, which features on its cover a guy vacuuming a woman's house, you know, rather scantily clad. So she gets the idea from this that what if there was a male cleaning service, but maybe what if we added in some pleasuring services as well? And through sort of coincidence and fate, she comes across a all male moving service. Some of the guys are quite young and hot, and kind of, you know, works out this arrangement where the women that she knows are all feeling a little bit unfulfilled and also wouldn't mind a little house cleaning on the side. It's a very sex positive film, and seldom, you know, do middle-aged women get their own sex comedies. I can think of very few, Ladies in Lavender, Calendar Girls, things like that. But this to me recalled a little bit The Full Monty from, 30 something years ago, where these are working class folks, these guys who learn to become better men, better dads, sort of stand up people along the way. And it's just very entertaining, very sweet. And there is one absolutely hilarious scene that I will not go into because it would spoil it, but it's worth seeing.
How to Please a Woman, Australian romantic comedy from writer-director Renee Webster, and it's her feature directorial debut. Andy, what do you think?
I agree with Lael almost completely on this. It's a sex positive feminist film, I would say, and it never hits you over the head with ideology, but it's also a very charming romantic comedy by the end. And it has, I have to mention one scene. I thought it was mostly quite good. And then there's one scene that I thought was absolutely brilliant, which is the best discreet sex scene you've ever seen. Does Lael know what scene I'm referring to?
Oh, that's the one I was referring to, yeah.
Okay.
So we won't give it away, but it sounds like you both reacted in the same way to this.
I'm sorry, I missed Lael saying that. But overall, it's very well done. It's very satisfying. The cast is really likable, which helps a lot. And it's a kind of you know, sex positive feminism that reminds me of my late great friend Cynthia Heimel, who was a, you know, a writer who blazed the trail in that, and she would have loved it.
How to Please a Woman is unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica, and then in just about a week, it'll be available on demand. My Donkey, My Lover, and I is written and directed by Caroline Vignal. It's a French comedy. Andy?
This is similar in tone, though I think much slighter than the last film. It's a woman who's having an affair with a married man. They're supposed to go on a vacation together, and at the last minute he tells her, my wife said she was going to do something else, but now we're going off on this 8-day hike of following the path that Robert Louis Stevenson took in his book Travels with My Ass. And she decides at the last minute to book onto that too, though it's not clear whether she's going to be in the same group as him. But she goes there and does connect with him and his wife and his daughter, and becomes sort of a local hero because she's let it be known generally why she's there. She said, because, you know, this married man I'm having an affair with stood me up and he's here. And I decided I would do the same vacation. It is, like I say, very slight, but very pleasant. Generally pretty funny, has a cute, goofy score to it, and it whips right by.
We're talking about the French comedy My Donkey, My Lover, and I. When we come back, we'll hear what Leo thought of the film, written and directed by Caroline Vignal. The film's unrated, and it's Film Week on KPCC. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear from our critics their favorite films of the first half of 2022. So in case you missed the reviews the first time around, it'll be a great compendium, a digest of the movies they think you need to catch up on before the end of the year. It's Film Week on KPCC and available on the KPCC app.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. And in case you missed what our critics said about the new Jordan Peele film, Nope, not too late for you to find out. You can download Film Week wherever you get your audio at kpecc.org or on the KPECC app. It's available to you whenever you want to listen to Film Week. I'm joined this week by critics Leah Lowenstein and Andy Klein. Andy was just giving us his thoughts on the French comedy My Donkey, My Lover, and I, which stars Laura Calamy and Benjamin Laverne, the film written and directed by Caroline Vignal. Leah, what did you think of it?
I enjoyed it. It is kind of slight, but it's charming. And Calamy is known from the French comedy series Call My Agent. And she has a wonderful kind of impulsive, kind of kooky, headstrong energy that she brings to this character of Antoinette. She actually won a César, which is like the French Oscar, for this role. And there's lots of warmth throughout the film. There's lots of surprising details. And, you know, the way that she shares with these other hikers, these other journey people that she's having an affair with this married guy, and the fact that they sort of egg her on and say, sure, do it. Why not? You know, he stood you up. He should have to own up to it. And, you know, that's a very French thing in a way. It's this kind of open, frank sexuality and discussion of romance in that way. It felt very, very French. This is a very French film. The bonding with the other people, the way that Antoinette, when she arrives at these different inns, they all greet her enthusiastically, the gorgeous French scenery. There's plenty of awkward moments, but the real kind of star of it is Calamy and the donkey and the way they bond together. It's almost, she has this kind of running monologue with the donkey, and through her relationship with the donkey, Patrick, by the way, is the donkey's name. Through her relationship with Patrick, she finds herself and figures out what it is that she wants. And, you know, it's a journey both in physical space and an interior journey. So it's a minor French trifle, but warm and endearing.
It's at Select Lemley and Harkins Theaters. My Donkey, My Lover and I is unrated. Next up on Film Week is the Japanese action comedy Baby Assassins, written and directed by Yugo Sakamoto, starring Akari Takahashi and Saori Izawa. Andy, what do you think of Baby Assassins?
I think this is for a very limited audience, of which I am one.
Okay.
It's a comedy about these two girls graduating high school who have been in a Yakuza assassin training program. And now that they've finished high school, it's time to put them into action. One of them is incredibly sullen and antisocial, and the other one is a motor mouth. So they have an interesting relationship there, and they're living together, not by their own decision, but because the group that trained them has put them together. It's ultra-violent with some very good hand-on-hand fights. I thought the gunfights were less effective. And it's also very funny. It's got things like the various Yakuza members criticizing each other for sexism, you know, in remarks that they're making, and a lot of that talk of sort of trying to be more current with the culture. I found it pure pleasure, but like I say, it is a limited audience. If you want to see a lot of bloodshed and a lot of fights in a comedy, this is where to go.
The Japanese film Baby Assassins, written and directed by Yugo Sakamoto. The film is available on the Hiya streaming service, and next month it'll be available in additional home formats. The film Queen of Glory is a comedy centering on a Ghanaian American. The film is written and directed by Nena Mensah. It's her feature directorial debut. Leo, what did you think of Queen of Glory?
I thought this was a surprisingly wonderful film. Mensah, who, you know, as you said, not only wrote and directed, she also stars in it. And she is so full of this immense energy, and she brings that to every frame of this film. She, as you pointed out, she is a PhD student at Columbia. She decides to give it all up and follow her married lover to Ohio. Lots of married lovers this week. Her mother dies unexpectedly, and she inherits a Christian bookstore in the Bronx, which she doesn't want. Things are complicated by the arrival of her cantankerous and unscrupulous father, various relatives and aunties, and a guy, a wonderful guy named Pitt, an ex-con who runs the bookshop. And this guy, played by a one named actor rapper named Miko, is so wonderfully humanizing. He has just all this great humor and these great sort of little bits of wisdom. And he kind of refocuses. He helps Sarah to refocus, but you don't know what she's going to do, and you don't know how she's going to reconcile her two cultures. This is not only a wonderful script by Mensah, but it's also so visually alive and evocative. There's just great rich color and sound. And there's an 8-minute sequence of the Ghanaian memorial service for her mother. And the way that Mensah decides to shoot it is just there's no dialogue. It's just her face. She's like this map of pain. And then there's this kind of explosive dance sequence that's a bold and stirring use of sound, color, close-ups. It just feels very alive, lived in, vibrant and authentic. And this film actually was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for First Feature. So it was a terrific film.
And I saw it was Tribeca Festival's Best New Narrative Director Award for Mensa as well.
That's so, right.
Mm-hmm. So Queen of Glory is the film written and directed by and starring Nena Mensa. The film's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale and at the Irvine Regal West Park. Jesus Kid is a film that is directed by Ali Murtabia. The film is unrated and it's in Portuguese. Andy, please tell us about this Brazilian film.
Okay. The hero is a writer. He's written 30 or more books about one hero, the Jesus Kid. And Westerns are going out of style, plus the Bolsonaro government is not gung-ho on them, and they want to start, they're pressuring his publisher. They actually want him to write the biography, the ghostwrite the autobiography of Bolsonaro, because he was a fan when he was a kid, but this guy is having none of it, and so he has to take an offer to write a screenplay that he's totally unsuited to do, and the screenplay is totally meta. His producer says, "We're going to put you in a hotel for 90 days. You cannot leave the premises of the hotel. And you're going to write a screenplay about a writer who's holed up in a hotel for 90 days trying to write a screenplay." So it's meta from the start. And then when the Jesus Kid shows up himself and starts writing the screenplay for him, you know that you're in this, you know, fantasy reality world where you don't know what is real ever and what is what he's imagining. It's really quite funny and satisfying. It's again another real trifle, but it's an enjoyable trifle.
We're talking about Jesus Kid, the Brazilian film directed by Ali Muritiba. The film is unrated, and it's streaming on the IndiePix film service and available in another week on demand for home viewing. The romantic drama Alone Together stars Katie Holmes, who also wrote and directed the film. Jim Sturgess and Derek Luke co-star. Leo, what did you think of Alone Together?
Also a trifle. It's a sweet look at people finding each other during the pandemic. This is set during the early days of COVID. Katie Holmes plays a woman named June who leaves Manhattan and goes to an Airbnb in upstate New York just to get away from it all. And supposedly her boyfriend is going to join her and they're going to isolate together. But he doesn't show up and says he needs to take care of his parents and that he'll join her at some point. But he still sort of is very slow in getting back to her. When she arrives at the Airbnb, to her consternation, there is another man staying there. And he's also booked this unit separately, and through a miscommunication, somehow they've double booked it. So at first, June was, of course, appalled, and she, you know, wants to get him out of there. And, you know, he says, "No, it's mine too." And then you can sort of guess what happens. They agree to stay for one night in the same house. But then little by little, they strike up a friendship that, well, it turns to something of a romance. And it's a little bit overly convenient. It's kind of unclear how they're able to get the Airbnb indefinitely. It seems to go on for, I don't know, a week or so. But you know what? Pandemic times, all rules are off. Katie Holmes gives a compelling performance. She's very sweet. It's a very small film. There's not, you know, just very tiny cast, and it's tender and it's pleasant. It's very pleasant.
Alone Together is unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and in another week, it's available on demand. The comedy The Enormity of Life is directed by Eric Swinderman, who co-wrote it with Carmen DeFranco, Breckin Meyer, Emily Kinney, and Giselle Eisenberg star. Andy, please tell us about the comedy The Enormity of Life.
Well, Breckin Meyer plays a guy who gets no pleasure from anything. He was raised in a completely unbearable household after his father died. His mother is bipolar and schizophrenic and several other diagnoses, and she tried to kill him 11 times as a kid, great comedy setup. And so basically he can't enjoy anything, so he decides to kill himself. He blunders it, but at the moment that he's blundering it, he gets a message that turns out to be a lawyer telling him that he has just inherited $250,000 from a relative he barely knew. He still wants to kill himself, but in the process of just dealing with you know, thinking about what he's going to do with this money, he bonds with this waitress who lives down the hall from him, who has an incredibly precocious kid who, in a reflection of the times we live in, is totally panicked and obsessed about mass shooter events. She's an 11-year-old kid who can reel off the odds of it happening and where each thing happened and, you know, exactly where the bullets entered the bodies. I mean, the kid is really troubled. But incredibly charming character. And, of course, you know, things develop into a romance. And then the film takes, at the end, a left turn that you don't see coming. It's probably the more realistic ending, but it's just not what I expected. And I think on some level, it's too dark to be satisfying at the end. I mean, it just does not work out well, and that, to me, was really hard to take, even though I think that, you know, this was a very intentional decision to not go full-on romantic comedy.
The Enormity of Life is a comedy. It's rated R and available on demand. We have time for just a brief review of My Name is Sarah, which is a historical drama. The film, directed by Stephen Orrett, who co-wrote it with Justina Pavlak, Susanna Sarowi, stars. Lael?
Well, this is based on a true story, Larry. It's about a Polish girl of 13 who is she's Jewish, and she is a refugee taken in by a farmer and his wife, and they don't know that she's Jewish, and so she pretends to be Christian because the penalty for taking in a Jew, of course, would be, you know, horrific. It's a fascinating story, and it's a compelling story. I just wish it had been given a better telling. The execution is sort of conventional, and it's not as kind of striking as the story itself is. I would have loved to see the parts of the film where you see just a little bit in the opening of how she escapes with her brother and how she makes her way to this family. But instead, it's sort of a lot about how she gets by. And, you know, such an amazing story, but I just thought it deserved a better telling.
My Name is Sarah is unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater, West LA, the Town Center, Lemley's in Encino, and on demand. And While the Women Are Sleeping, starring Beat Takeshi Kitano, Wayne Wang is the director. Andy, give us 30 seconds, please, on While the Women Are Sleeping.
It's kind of ponderous. It's another meta thing about a writer trying to write, and we don't know what's really happening and what's not. It's been on the shelf for 6 years. And
wow.
The reason it got released now is that the star is the same guy who starred in Drive My Car last year, which was such a critical success. I've had ups and downs with Wayne Wang, and one of the downs.
All right. The film's in Japanese and subtitled. While the Women Are Sleeping is streaming on the Film Movement Plus service. All right, we're going to continue with our critics, and to all our pleasure, add two more critics. We'll be talking with them about their favorite films to this point in the year, and also how critics deal with giving tough reviews to films that are made by people they know. We'll be back. Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, and joining us to this point have been critics Andy Klein and Lael Lowenstein, and now we're so pleased to have joining us as a quartet of critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcast Unspooled, and Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. There'll be a great chance to talk with our critics about a challenge that I'm sure each of them has faced to varying degrees, and that is when you have to review a film where you know someone or multiple people involved in the production, maybe, you know, a director, producer, actor, even people doing publicity for it. And Tim, let me start with you. How frequently has that happened to you?
Now, we'll call it veteran film critic, as opposed to old film critic, it happens a lot because, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and I've come to know a great many filmmakers and actors. One of my best friends is a very important actor. So these people all around me, I have a hard time not engaging a film where somebody that rolls by in that credits is not somebody I kind of know. And although it doesn't really bother me anymore, I used to go to great pains back in the day when I was a young film critic. Even though I didn't really know that many filmmakers, it was mostly a race thing. It was about reviewing the films of African American filmmakers, of which there were not very many back then. And I felt pressed not to be the one of very few black film critics to say something funky about those black folks' films. So it's kind of analogous in the same way.
Yeah.
Today, it doesn't bother me at all. Folks know, hey, look, if you want me to review your film, understand I'm going to be reviewing your film. So if you don't ask me to do it, if you don't want me to actually do it, and it doesn't bother me at all. But way back in the day, it was quite vexing.
Did it lead to uncomfortable conversations in any of these instances?
Today, not at all, because everybody knows better than they even bother me about it.
Okay.
You know, they all know better. Way back in the day, though, because I came to know filmmakers like Matty Rich and Leslie Harris and John Singleton became a friend of mine. And so these things became... Yeah. Issues back in the day, and I got into conversations once or twice with a few filmmakers from way back then who you know, I didn't care for James Bond III's film Death by Temptation. We're going way back, 1990 now. And then when I met him a few years later, because he was an actor too, he literally said to me, "Hey, you remember that movie I made? It's the only film he ever made. And it's the one thing that we had a conversation about."
Oh, funny. And of course, our Peter Rayner has had his run in with Quentin Tarantino. Amy Nicholson, what about for you?
I'm aspiring to be as confident as Tim is. I'm aspiring to move through the world with that sort of blunt honesty. You know, I think about watching, you know, the Roger Ebert documentary that came out for a few years ago, Life Itself, where they talk about his relationship with Scorsese, about how he became friends with Scorsese and yet continued to review Scorsese films negatively when he felt like he had to. And I've wanted to be that person. But I think, yeah, like for a while, most of my career, I've like clung to kind of not reviewing anyone that I've ever met. But Tim is exactly right. The longer you live in this world, it just gets smaller and smaller. And I am definitely at a stage now where I feel almost radioactive when I walk into a room of creative people. Like I should be wearing a sign that says, "Don't talk to me or I can never review you again," because I'm so scared of stepping on anybody's toes. But I'm definitely thinking about recalibrating that rule. Because, you know, for one thing, even just in the time since I've become a critic, it's become harder and harder for a small film to even get reviewed in the first place. And so almost the most supportive thing you can do if you care about a filmmaker is write, I think, an honest negative, maybe even on an honest mixed review so that it doesn't go totally ignored. I'm a people pleaser.
So, Leah, what about for you?
Oh, God, Larry. Well, there's two incidents that I'll never forget. One was I was at a film festival and I had just seen a film, a small film, and there was a brunch afterward, and I didn't know that the filmmaker was going to be there. And apparently, the publicist had told him that I was reviewing his film, which is sort of a no-no. You really try not to mingle with these people until your review comes out. And he came up to me and said, "Oh, I hear you're reviewing my film. What'd you think?" And I really didn't like the film. So I just said, "You know, I could tell that you really cared about the subject matter." And that was as diplomatic as I could be in that moment. It was just sort of my way of trying to get out of having to be confrontational. And then there was another situation where I had eviscerated a film and many years later met the filmmaker who had not forgotten me, although I didn't know who she was at the time that I had reviewed the film. And she pointed out, she said, "Oh yes, you were the one that tore me to shreds." And I felt so awful about that. And I, you know, I said, I'm really sorry, but that was, you know, I just, it wasn't my cup of tea. Did the best I could, but I know your film was important to you. So the best I could do in that situation, but it is awkward.
Andy, what about your experiences?
Well, I was pretty good friends in film school with Alex Cox, and it was easy for me to write about Repo Man and Sid and Nancy and a few of his later films that I thought were good.
Highway Patrolman.
Yeah, Highway Patrolman in particular, yeah. But there was one that most of my career I've been the film editor, which means I just won't cover, so I'll assign to somebody else to cover films by people I know. But during one of the patches when I was not in charge at my publication, they made me review a film of Alex's that I thought was kind of a hot mess. And I, it was very difficult. And, you know, Alex never said a word about it afterwards when I ran into him. He was totally cool with it. That's one kind of thing I really, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, you just don't review those films. The other place where I felt a push and pull is I'm on Team Tarantino, you know, pretty much all down the line. And he, you know, he has expressed being a fan of me as much as I've expressed being a fan of him, because we have similar tastes in marginal cinema. And but I have to say, every time I've criticized something and I've run into him afterwards, he can quote my criticism back to me, whatever I thought was negative, and says, that's fair enough.
Really?
You know, he's totally cool with it, and of course he's in a position where he can be. But, you know, he used my Kill Bill reviews for the liner notes of the DVDs, even though my Kill Bill 2 review was not an unmitigated rave. So I feel like with him, even when I'm controlling the scene, I will review those films because they're going to be the most important film that week.
All right.
But it has not, you know, it has not damaged anything in my sort of long distance friendship with him, which is mostly, you know, I clearly am on the team that is into what he does. So those kind of conflicts happen. The idea of running into somebody who I didn't know and I've totally trashed their film, it's kind of, it really is not fun.
Yeah, we've had experiences on Film Week, and I don't know whether any of you have been a critic when it's happened back pre-pandemic, and, you know, we'd have directors or stars who'd be coming to the studio, and you folks would be with me here in the studio, and outside would be the person from a film you were reviewing, and you have to give a bad review. I don't, Tim, had that ever happened to you, and you know the person is ready to come into the studio?
Oh, yeah, sitting there right on the other side of that window, you know, looking right at you.
We don't make it easy for you.
And I am capable of talking about a film honestly without ripping it to pieces. When I was a young film critic, I either hated a movie or I loved a movie. Now I know how to modulate a little bit so that the guy sitting on the other side of the window doesn't come in and just, you know, we're going to talk later or something like that.
All right. We're talking with our Film Week critics, four of them joining us to talk about some of the challenge of knowing someone or being friendly with someone, and you end up reviewing the film. Critics are with us are Andy Klein, Leo Lowenstein, Amy Nicholson, and Tim Cogshell. The quartet continues with me, and they're going to briefly offer their favorite film or two of the first half of 2022. So if it's something you've missed or you haven't heard about, it's a chance for you to catch up a bit. We'll get to that when we continue on Film Week in just 1 minute.
Thank you.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting an evening in focus, Goya. The museum's galleries come to life at this interactive event, celebrating the opening of the exhibition, I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. Enjoy live music, art-making activities for all ages, live model drawing, tours, and more. Free with museum admission. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. More information at nortonsimon.org. Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.
You're listening to Film Week, and in case you missed our reviews of this week's movies, you didn't really miss them. All you need to do is download Film Week wherever you get your podcasts or go to kpcc.org. All the episodes, including the latest, are right there, or you can listen on your smartphone KPCC app. I'm joined right now with critics Tim Cogshell, Amy Nicholson, Andy Klein, and Leo Lowenstein, and we're going to hear from each of them a film or two that they particularly loved in the first half of this year as we are just past the halfway point. Amy Nicholson, let's start with you. What film has really stood out for you the first half of the year?
Well, you know, the film that I can still say I have never seen anything like this film, I'm so glad that I've watched it, is RRR, that like gigantic sprawling like Telugu film from India that came out earlier this year and is now on Netflix. It has the most insane action I have seen in a film in such a long time. Like the opening scene, the way you get to meet one of the characters is like him facing down an army of 700 people and just like launching into this crowd with this like glint in his eye that says, I will do what it takes. And the thing about that scene is this guy is sort of a, you think of him as a bad guy. This film is kind of structured like Heat almost. It's like a giant epic movie about two guys who are like rivals, starring two major Indian movie stars who are playing like real life Indian revolutionaries from the 1920s who are fighting against, you know, British imperialism. It is just shot for shot one of the most insane, marvelous, passionate things I've ever seen. It really brings like heart back into an action film, and it's got people fighting tigers and men riding on each other's shoulders holding swords. I mean, it is a staggering film.
We're talking about RRR, Rise, Roar, Revolt. It is streaming on Netflix, the version dubbed in Hindi. The original version is in Telugu with English subtitles. It was first reviewed on Film Week. That's Amy's pick. Andy, your top pick of the first half of the year.
We reviewed this, I guess, about 6 months ago, After Yang, which is a science fiction film, futuristic film, but not dystopian for once, about a family who have bought a robot, an Asian-themed robot, to be a companion to their adopted Asian daughter so that she gets some sense of the culture. And the film opens with the robot basically, you know, having a burnout, and they're not going to be able to replace him or fix him. It's a very low-key film. It has nice, modest special effects, but that's just not what it's about. It's about what it means to be this possibly sentient robot who, in fact, must be sentient because he has a certain a life outside of the household that they did not know about, until they start probing his memory chip after he's, after he's burned out, and start discovering all these things about him and what memories he has preserved and what was important to him. And it's clear that certain things were important to him. It's a really thoughtful, gentle, amusing film. and not quite a comedy. I mean, more like a drama, but Colin Farrell is the lead. He's great. The cast is generally really, really excellent.
It's written and directed by Koganada. The film is After Yang, and it's streaming on Hulu, rated PG, Andy's pick, for the first half of the year. Tim, what's your choice?
Well, there are a few, but I'll knock off a couple quick. Hustle, Adam Sandler's
movie. Oh, I really like that movie.
Great NBA movie, all these NBA stars in it. It's funny, yet still very moving. It's really a father and son story is what it is. So I hope people pay attention and catch that one. Operation Mincemeat, yet another story from World War II, which we had not heard of, an espionage story, Colin Firth and everybody, a true story that actually happened. It's daring, it's intriguing and fascinating, and I can't believe I'd never heard of it. And a wicked little movie called Asking For It, which is over on Hulu, which is a sort of present day movie about these young women who are going to go out into a world full of belligerent men and take care of some business. But they structure it in a very particular way, some really excellent filmmaking in this movie, all these wonderful little montages. But the thing that it's about is what I like the most about that film. And so, yeah, really, really good little movies out there that I hope people catch.
All right. Asking For It is streaming on Hulu and also available to rent on Amazon Prime Video. Hustle, starring Adam Sandler and Queen Latifah, is on Netflix. And Amy, a big fan of that film as well. And I really enjoyed it. And Operation Mincemeat is a favorite of Lael's from the first half of the year. Colin Firth starring, that's on Netflix. John Madden, the director of that film. Lael, your favorites.
Yes, I did like Operation Mincemeat. I thought that was just absolutely compellingly told and full of suspense, beautifully mounted and really well acted. Nice little espionage thriller. Another film that I really enjoyed, which was also, it's kind of a crime thriller. It's a little movie called The Outfit with a terrific performance by Mark Rylance as a tailor who knows much more than he lets on about a local crime syndicate. And it's a mystery. It's like a drama. There's some romance in it. And every detail of this film feels period authentic and absolutely full of life. One last one that I also really enjoyed was a documentary called Mao about the design visionary Bruce Mao, who is a really forward-thinking guy who brought great change to the design world and is revered by many in his field. Just a terrific, terrific piece of filmmaking.
All right. The Outfit, starring Mark Rylance, is on Amazon Prime Video, available to rent. The director, Graham Moore of that, by the way, wrote the screenplay for The Imitation Game. And Mao, that documentary, is available on demand on Amazon Prime Video. And let me go back to you just quickly to get an additional film, Amy. You have another one you want to throw in.
I do, actually. There's a horror film called Dashcam that came out a few months ago that's directed by Rob Savage. He did that movie called Host that came out very, very early on in a pandemic that was like a ghostly seance story that took place over Zoom. Dashcam is another found footage horror film. And I think this one kind of got appraised wrong. So I want to take this moment to stick up for it, because the trick that he does in Dashcam is the heroine, put in quotes, you know, the protagonist of the film is like a MAGA anti-vaxxer. Driving through this like horrific night that she's having. And because that character is so polarizing that I think it adds this interesting dimension to the film, you know, because to me, horror movies are all about testing your empathy in the audience. You know, like, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? Look at this pain, look at this like torture that somebody's going through. Mm. And this character is very obnoxious, and like her obnoxiousness is part of it. And I just think it's such a complicated, fun, wicked, little, mean-tempered, brave film that I enjoyed to pieces.
All right. Mm-hmm. The film is Dashcam. It's available for rent on Amazon Prime Video. And Andy also had one of his favorites first half of the year, Chris Pine and Tandy Newton, Newton, starring in All the Old Knives, which is set in beautiful Carmel by the Sea here in California. All right, that's our critics with a few of their picks for the best films of the first half of 2022. Thanks so much for joining us on Film Week for our critics, Lael, Andy, Tim, and Amy. Have a wonderful weekend. Back with you next week for the next Film Week on KPCC or wherever you get your podcasts.
What we learned investigating the death of Chicano student activist Oscar Gomez.
He ended up punching Oscar once, a good, nice hit.
So the big question for me is whether Oscar's death and his fatal injuries are part of a pattern.
It sounds like you ran almost every theory to its end.
Binge all 8 episodes of Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.